to introduce John Park Lee. Well, as you've heard, I am John Lee, and I am an alcoholic. Very exciting to be here tonight, home of the new camp. I don't even mention our team. Have to have a telescope to find them way down in the cellar. I think, what was it, 17 and a half games out of first. But as they say, don't sell your shin plasters short, boys. The South will rise again. I'd like to talk with you tonight, if I may, about the program which has been read to you by an earlier speaker. Because it seems to me, the longer I am a member of this fellowship, the more important it becomes for us to talk about, to think about, and to study these 12 steps which provide the basis for the recovery of now hundreds of thousands of people. There was a time when I engaged in a good deal of philosophical gropings in outer space. I came rather profound and quite erudite on the psychological overtones of our program. But I discovered that this wasn't helping anybody to stay sober and wasn't doing me any good, and that if I was to have any contributions to make to AA, it would be to pass on to you what I have come to see in these 12 steps, which fascinate me because of the unending source of new ideas which thinking about them produces. Now, one of the exciting and wonderful things about our fellowship is that we have no party line, there is no dogma, there is no word from on high, there is no official interpretation of these steps which anybody is required to accept. Each of us is given the privilege, or rather, more accurately, each of us is required to adopt an understanding of these steps for ourselves. And so, of course, what I'm going to say to you tonight represents merely my own views and has such force as only the sense of my remarks may have for you. Before I would talk on the steps, I would like to say two introductory things. First of all, has to do with the pronoun which appears all the way through the program. The program, as you've heard it read to you tonight, has we. We do this, we do that. And this is quite true and quite accurate because we are all in this together and we are doing it together. But actually, my friends, when we are putting the program to work, the pronoun is I. No one else can do these steps for me. Nobody else can take them for me. Nobody else can study them for me. Nobody else can make them work in my life. It is I. And while I will use in talking with you the pronoun we, I hope that you all will be remembering that each of you must translate this into the pronoun I and see how this applies to your life as I feel it does to mine. The second thing is that you will hear people in AA say, and this of course is what I pointed out, our right and privilege, that you don't have to pay any particular attention to the order in which the steps are arranged. And if you can't get one step, just pass it on and go to the next. Now, this says validity, of course, for some people, but it seems to me the more I have tried to study these steps and apply them to my life, the more important the order in which they are arranged becomes. They have not just been thrown together higgledy-piggledy. But I will try, as I talk with you tonight, to show how one step leads out of the other and how the successful functioning in your life of a later step is very largely dependent on the steps leading into it. So much for credit. Everybody agrees, no matter what he may say about the order of the other steps, that everybody agrees the only place you can begin is with the first. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. This is accepted by all people working in the field of alcoholic therapy as absolutely essential. And while the exact language may not be used, it is fascinating to see that whether the therapy is being provided by members of Alcoholics Anonymous or by a psychiatrist or a psychologist or an informed priest or clergyman or just by some person who knows something about alcoholism, they all recognize that here is where the beginning must be made, and without the first step, nothing is ever going to happen. The interesting, fascinating thing about our disease is that recovery from it depends upon our making the diagnosis. Now, you don't need a medical degree to diagnose alcoholism. A 3-year-old child can make a diagnosis. But the diagnosis that others make about me have no significance at all until I make it about myself. And this is what the first step is all about. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Another thing that interests me is, in view of much is being written, much being read these days on the power of positive thinking, to note that our recovery rests on the most profoundly negative thing a man can say about himself. I'm licked. I'm beaten. I give up. There's nothing I can do about my life. My life has become unmanageable. I am powerless. There's nothing more negative you can say about yourself than this. And yet on this profoundly negative statement, the confession of total defeat rests the basis for the following victory. All my life I've been in the business of using words in one way or another, and you will note perhaps a finicky, perhaps overly nice discrimination about words and their meaning as I go along, but I have always felt that we have to expand our understanding of this word admit just a little bit to grasp what is truly involved in this first step. Now, in the course of my life, I have been, among other things, a newspaper reporter. And you have read countless articles such as I wrote, that Joe Blow, such and such address, arrested last night by the police loitering in the vicinity of a store which had broken into, quote, admitted, unquote, after questioning that he had broken into the store. What is involved here, you see, is pressure. Outside force is applied to the situation, and Joe, who doesn't want to admit any complicity in this crime at all, is compelled to admit it. It's dragged out of it. It is also, in our situation, a cerebral experience. We listen to somebody like John Lee standing up in front of an AA meeting and describing what alcoholics do and the experience of alcoholism, and a person listening and laying his own life experience against the life experience of the speaker says, yes, these things coincide. I guess I'm an alcoholic. This is admission. This is an intellectual exercise. It's necessary. It's good. It's important. But it doesn't do quite enough because there's another process involved in our living, and this is our emotional process, our attitude. And while many a man has admitted under the pressure, the force of events that back him into a corner so he's unable to answer people, you think you can handle alcohol? Why don't you? You're not an alcoholic? Why do you get drunk all the time? You're not an alcoholic? Why don't you help your wife and kids? All these arguments we give up and finally say, okay, I admit I'm an alcoholic. But something more is involved. And on the inside, I'm saying, yeah, I admit I'm an alcoholic, but I get back on my feet again. I get my job back, I get my health back, I get some money in the bank. I'll show these people I can do that. You see, we haven't adopted an attitude towards the problem. Intellectually, we're compelled to admit it, and quite sincerely. But the way we feel about it is also important. And so I suggest that when you think of this word admit, you think of it as also involving acceptance. Because accepting is a purely voluntary act. You can't make a person accept anything. This is an act of the free will. And so when I accept my alcoholism, I go the whole way which is necessary to begin my recovery. My mind has accepted and admitted the facts that seem to identify me as having this disease, but my attitude has come to the point where I say, I may not like this. It doesn't make me happy. I wish I weren't an alcoholic. It would be nice to be able to drink with the boys, but here it is. This is the way it's got to be. This is the way it's got to be. Where do I go from here? I'm convinced, after talking to many alcoholics for some years, I was working in a clinic in Philadelphia and trying to find out why alcoholics had slipped. If we could solve this problem, we would be able to help many, many people. But I was convinced that the very man who said he had no trouble with the first step slipped because he had only had part of the first step experience. We talk a lot about resentment. We must remember the basic resentment of all of them, in which we've got to deal the resentment of our being alcoholic. The thing that makes us sore when this dope that works next to us in the office, who isn't nearly as smart or as capable, as able as we are, can drink and we can't. The resentment because our wives or husbands can drink and we can't. The resentment that even these kids of ours can drink and we can't. This is part of not accepting our alcoholism, and it rankles and burns, although we may be totally unaware of why we're upset until we're drinking again. But these to me, extremely important that we guide the new men and women who come to us not only to an intellectual awareness of the nature of alcoholism, but to help them to develop this attitude of surrender, of giving up, of settling, of accepting the fact of our alcoholism. Actually, you know, the basis, the problem of maturity is, among other things, learning to accept limitations that the passage of time imposes on you. The truly immature person is a person who fights against the idea that he isn't as young as he was 20 years ago. We see the immaturity in the man who's still living back in his college days and spends his time rehearsing the big games and can tell you who played right tackle in such and such a game in such and such a year. The woman who avoids the passage of time by trying to dress like a teenager when she's in her 60s. All of these are examples of emotional immaturity, of not being grown up, of not having to do the inevitable, to accept the things we cannot change. If we remind ourselves every time we repeat our serenity prayer, this is part of growing up, my friends, and we must grow up in this area of our alcoholism as we grow up in all other areas of our life. So we admit and accept fact that we are alcoholics, powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanaged. Well, now, right away, this illustrates the point I was trying to make, that you must move on from the first to second step. Diagnosis never brought recovery to anybody. You know, see how obvious it would be. You go to a doctor, you have a pain in your tummy, he says you've got appendicitis, you say, thank you very much, doctor, and walk out. He's going to die. And so many people seem to think that all they have to do is take the first step and their alcoholic problems are solved. I admit I'm an alcoholic, so what? Got to do something about it. And this is what the rest of the program's about. And you see, since, as you say in the first step, that we are powerless, I am powerless, it seems to me the sensible, logical, compelling thing to do is to look for a source of power. And this is what the second step is about. Come to see that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I need power in my life. I find that it's got to come from outside. First step indicates this. The second step really confirms it. And so, after diagnosis, comes the second step, the indication of the source of help for the situation. And then there's a word here that's always interested me, and I'm sure it does you. Why sanity? Does this mean that when we drink, we are insane? No, people that observe me would say probably, And I suppose this has been true about yourselves. And from a medical point of view, it is quite true that with the alcoholic, it's alcohol in his bloodstream, he is insane, although not, of course, from a legal point of view. But here again comes my love for words and their basic meaning, and I think this word has its basic sense of wholeness. Not sanity as opposed to insanity, but I came to believe that a power greater than myself can make me whole again. And how we need this, because when we think of our lives, we see how our alcoholism has fragmented us, has broken us up. You're of my generation. You used to read Stephen Lightcock, didn't you, about the man that mounted his horse and rode madly off in all directions? This is the alcoholic. Come to believe that a power greater than myself can make me a whole person again, to give my life integrity. Here again, if I stop here, still nothing's happened. I'm like a man who suddenly realizes he's been living in a house without any light. And somebody tells me that down the street there's a power station. Well, just knowing this isn't going to bring any light into my house. I see that my trouble is alcoholism. I realize I'm powerless to help myself. I come to see that there's a source of power outside me. But if I stop here, still nothing happens. I'm pushed, you see, on to say what next in the program. And what next is the third step. The application of this source of power in my life. Make a decision to turn my life over to the care of God as I can understand it. Diagnosis. Understanding what needs to be done. And the next step, the action. As we discuss this program together, you'll see this cyclical pattern reverting, coming back over and over again. Where awareness of what's wrong and understanding of what needs to be done and action to do it just keep weaving steadily through the program all the way through. This is why it's so important, again, to keep the sequence of the steps in order. This is a difficult step, the third. It's one that honest men and women cannot take lightly. Some of us who had the advantage of being brought up in homes with formal religious education may find this not too difficult. For some people who have never had this experience, who perhaps have had unfortunate, tragic experiences with religion and its advocates, this is even more difficult. And so we must, it seems to me, be extremely understanding of the honest doubts of men and women who grapple with it. And not ever attack people because they don't believe. Far better to express an honest doubt than to pretend that this step has meaning for you until it does. There are ways of dealing with doubt. The first is to recognize it, admit it. I remember talking to a wonderful kid who was, as many alcoholics were, in frightful shape. He'd been given up by his family and his parents, and finally I got called into the situation by the lawyer who was administering a trust fund of which he was a beneficiary, and we had luncheon together, the two of us, and we were talking, and I finally said, "Bill, do you believe in anything?" And he said, "No, I don't." I said, "Well, the AA program is going to present some problems for you then, because the AA program is thus and so," and I recited these steps to him. He says, "Yes, I can see this." I said, "Well, you do this. You don't believe, you honestly doubt. Let's put this into the form of a prayer. When you get up tomorrow morning, say, 'Oh God, if there is a God, help me to stay sober.' That night when you get into bed, you've been sober, say, 'Oh God, if there is a God, thank you.'" I said, "This is the prayer an honest doubter can make." He looked at me as though I was a little nuts and said he'd try it. 10 days later, I heard from him. He said, "John, you'll be interested in knowing I've dropped the qualifying clause," and hung up. God, as I understand him, can accept this expression of honest doubt because he made us reasoning creatures. He expects that we will have our doubts and our fears. and my work, which is in connection with our church, I know that even the most devout, convinced followers of God will have their moments too when they doubt. So here are the first three steps. It seems to me this is a sort of an entrance experience. This gets us into AA. Now we're in, and we're full of this wonderful new excitement that our speaker spoke to us about, this excitement that in a very real way continues as long as we walk in AA meetings. Each one is as new as the new day. But the program won't let us stop. And the next six steps, it seems to me, are the foundation for our future life in AA. All right, we're in this group. We're part of a wonderful new fellowship. We've turned our life and will over to the care of God as we understand Him, often times and terms which are not quite clear to us, but which we hope are going to be real enough to keep us sober. It seems to me quite logical we should take a look at ourselves, an honest, sober look, and this is, of course, what the fourth step is about. Make a searching and fearless moral inventory. Interesting, as you go around the country and talk to AA groups, the importance they place on this step. I know of a group that seems to me quite contrary to the spirit of AA, but keeps people sober. One group I know of, they have to write down their inventory and submit it to a committee. Yes, this is true. This, to me, is taking somebody else's inventory with a vengeance, but their theory is they want to make sure they're bad enough to get in. You know, for a while in New York, they had a terrible time with trying to provide medical treatment for alcoholics. They had one clinic for alcoholics that took a fellow too. They'd say, you know, you can't take him in. He's too drunk. Say, okay, we'll take him down to Bellevue. And he's taken to Bellevue. You can't bring him in. He's not drunk enough. So they'd have to take the poor guy across the street and shove a few more drinks in him and get him drunk enough to get treatment. This is funny in a way, but it's a tragic story of what has happened to alcoholic therapy in our country. Well, anyway, we take this inventory, and in my opinion, we take it for our own purpose, not to show, but to make this sincere effort to look at ourselves in the light of the cold, gray, sober dawn. Through eyes which are not bloodshot, perhaps for the first time in years. Written in a hand which probably isn't shaking for the first time in many months. If there are new people here tonight, I would counsel them in making this inventory to remember that nobody is completely black. Some people make their inventory and take a look at it. What happens when they go out and get drunk? They can't stand it. Because they forget that there are virtues, that there are strengths that each of us has. You must write down, since this is an inventory, the assets as well as the liabilities. The liabilities we are going to try to get rid of or control or reduce. It is the assets on which we must build. And since this is not to be shown to anyone, you can take the risk of being slightly immodest by looking at yourself and saying, yes, I have certain strengths, I have certain capacities, I do certain things well. Because this is where you're going to have to build your life. Well, here again, you see, you don't dare stop. Because this is likely, as I've pointed out, to have a quite depressing effect. Because, you know, we have been living in a cloud cuckoo land when we were drinking. We didn't know what life was like. We didn't know what our friends were like. We didn't know what our loved ones were like. And least of all, we knew what we were like. And now we are suddenly seeing ourselves. And it represents an appalling picture. Enormous need for renovation, for clearing away, for rebuilding. And so we must hustle on through the ways in which the program shows us how to deal with a sense of guilt and shame which this honest inspection of our lives produces. We admit to God, to ourselves, and other human beings just what's wrong as we look at this program and see it. Well, now, sometimes people are puzzled by this. Even the most primitive concept of God acknowledges that he knows everything that's going on. And a man will say, now, what's the point of my admitting this to him? He knows this, surely. Well, that isn't the point. You're not admitting it to him for his sake. You're admitting it to it for yours. It's to show how I stand in relationship to him. What kind of a person I am that I've turned my life over to. It begins to give me a new appreciation of what a magnificent thing it is that he's willing to be interested in my life. Well, you say, I grasp that, but why admit it to myself? Didn't I admit this when I wrote it down? No, there's a funny psychological point involved here. I can just write down that John Lee is thus and so, and it doesn't carry near as much weight as after I've written it down, I say, yes, this is a pretty fair description of John Lee as I see him today. And finally, we know the value of discussing things that vex and worry and frighten us with a trusted friend. Again, if I may sound like Father Time, I would like to advise the new men, and particularly the new gals, to be a trifle circumspect to the details into which they go in discussing their inventory with other people. Now, this is considered no reflection on any person in AA, but just a reflection on all of us as human beings. Receiving private, intimate confessions is an enormous burden for anybody to carry. It requires training, usually, and experience, and actually great fortitude. And sometimes, with the best intentions in the world, unless we are extremely careful, we may be a source of enormous embarrassment to our friends. For instance, Bill comes to me and says, I'm awful worried, John. I'm having trouble at home. My wife and I can't seem to agree. We're quarreling all the time, and I'm awfully afraid I'm going to drink. And we talk about it, and I tell Bill I'm sorry, and I hope that as he continues his sobriety, that he and his wife will work these things out all right. And he goes away a little bit comforted because he's had a chance to express something that's worrying to him. But then Jim comes to me and says, John, I'm worried about Bill. He's awfully jittery these days. And you see, the instant temptation for me is to put Jim's mind at rest about Bill by telling him, no, don't worry about his drinking. He's just having trouble at home. But here you see, I have been guilty of a gross violation of personal confidence, and yet with the best intentions in the world. This is why those of us who listen to the problems of our friends must be extremely circumspect as we talk to others, and it's the hardest thing to do to avoid sharing knowledge, particularly about other people's misfortunes, in which we all seem to take, insidiously enough, a kind of a vicarious delight. But here again, we must move on. You see, the horrible plight you're in if you stop here. You have written down enough evidence that you're allowed, and you've told God about it, you've admitted to yourself and somebody else, the whole world knows it. You've got to do something about it, and this is what the next two steps are. This is a problem of guilt. You know, some people don't understand us AAs, and they say, you people are eliminating guilt. Not a bit. We say people ought to be sorry for what they do when they drink. We've hurt people. We've hurt them terribly. We should feel guilty. We have this way of dealing with guilt. Not denying it. Not trying to laugh it off. But accepting it. And struggling with it as the next two steps. Describe it in relationship to God as we understand him. And the next two in relationship to our fellow men. We become willing to have God change these things in our lives that have caused these things of which we're so ashamed. And then we ask him to do it. Now, when I knew a good deal more about the AA program than I do now, I thought that this was just a phony differentiation, that they actually probably, when they got the steps written, they only had 11, and they thought that was a bad number, so they divided this step up to make 12. But now I am wiser. This tells us something about God as the writers of this program understood. It expresses a profound theological tenet which may surprise you. This is an expression of the theological tenet of free will. It says that there's no use asking God to do something for us that we don't want him to do. We heard a brilliant example of the alcoholic's prayer tonight. Our speaker didn't really want God to stop her drinking. She wanted him to do something about the trouble she was getting into because of drinking. She wasn't willing, you see. This is not a reflection on her, but this is an expression of the typical alcoholic prayer. I am not willing to have God stop me drinking. Therefore, all my prayers to him have no meaning whatsoever and are disregarded. A.A. didn't mention this first. If any of you have ever read the writings of St. Augustine, 6th century, you'll find out when he was a young man, he had a high time in the flesh parts of his own town. And he was fond of the gals, and there were moments where he'd wake up the morning after with a sense of guilt, and he'd say, "Oh God, make me chaste, but not quite yet." How many of us have prayed in the fit of an anguished hangover, "Get me out of this, and I'll be a good boy"? We have to be willing to have God remove these defective character, and this may cost us. Some of you may have read the wife of Peter Marshall by her wife, his wife, Catherine, and one of the prayers, or one of the sermons in the back of this book, is on the question of the perils of prayer. And Peter Marshall pointed out that it's very dangerous to ask God to do something for us unless we're willing to have him do it, because he just might. Now, a lot of us go to church, we sing a hymn very piously with lusty voices, "Take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold." We would be sick to death if the Lord took us seriously on that one. He goes on further to tell about a man who realized one of his besetting sins was impatience. And he was praying sincerely for the Lord to make him patient. A couple of days later, he found himself simply blowing his top over a stupid girl in his office. And so finally the thought struck him that maybe this was the way the Lord was teaching him patience. One of the besetting sins of many of us men is a kind of petty dishonesty, which may actually grow into grand theft, chiseling on the expense account. And since we come to AA meetings and we hear other people talking to us that this is a program for honest people, we begin to realize that this applies to honesty as it relates us to the boss. And yet we think that we've been getting a lot of benefits out of this chiseling. Enable us to live at a higher standard of living, to have things for ourselves and our families that we wouldn't otherwise get. Don't pray to God to make us honest unless we're willing to give up these things for us. We can then ask God to make us sobriety unless we're willing to pay the price involved in things. So these are two tough, vital steps. But they're the restorative steps, putting us into a right relationship within the areas of life which we must live. All of us must live in three ways. We must live with ourselves. That's the fourth step, get squared away with ourselves. We must live with God, certainly, if he is to be the director of our lives. And this is these two steps. And finally, you must live with our fellow man, and that's what the next two steps are about. Exactly the same process, you see. A list of those we've hurt, and become willing to make amends first, and then do it. This is not perfunctory making amends. This is amends that may cost us. And we do it sometimes with fear and trembling. And yet it's the universal experience of those of us who've tried this, that Perhaps these are the two most rewarding steps of all, at least, in the way of restoring relationships with our fellow men. We marvel at the willingness of people we've hurt to say, sure, forget it. Marvel at the people that we borrowed money from and never paid back, so sure, now I'm glad you're sober, pay me back when you can. So let me remind you what a woman reminded me of when I was speaking this way one night. When the meeting was over, she came up and she said, John, thank you for your talk, which I enjoyed very much. She said, you know, my husband has been galloping all around town, saying he's sorry to everybody he's ever hurt, and he's never mentioned a word to me. Well, the funny thing about wives, we work hard for them, we bring home the paycheck, and we keep the roof over their heads and everything. We think this is telling them that we love them, but there's nothing like verbalizing. And so in the same way, we think when we sober up and fly right and come home every day and don't stay out anymore, that this is saying to our wives we're sorry. But it costs so little to say I'm sorry. And it's so important, particularly to those who are the nearest and dearest to us and whom we so frequently overlook as we go about this vital process of making amends. Well, now we've pretty well cleared away the underbrush, haven't we? We've cleaned out our lives pretty well, and we've laid a new foundation for our experience in AA. And here we are looking ahead now to these weeks and months and even years that we realize lie ahead. Now, many men and women don't often speak about this at AA meetings, but I'm sure that it occurs to them, well, now, what's going to happen to me 20 years from now? Am I still going to be going to AA meetings? Am I still going to hear Susie tell about the time she locked up? Get locked up? Or Joe tell his experiences? Is this all it's going to be the rest of my life? This isn't funny, my friends. This is dynamite. Because we are growing up as a group now. As you know, next July is going to be 25 years out of Long Beach. It's a wonderful party, and we're all going to share in this. But maturity imposes new problems upon us. And a great deal of the excitement, the so-called honeymoon phase, passes. And another thing that distressed me when I talked to the men and women that I talked to in our hospital was their lips. Did you go to AA? Sure, I went to AA. Did it help you? Yes, I stayed sober for years, 3 years, 5 years. But what happened? Well, I stopped going. But why did you stop? Well, they knew I was in AA, didn't want to hurt my feelings, they back and fill for a while, and I said, come on, tell me what. They say, well, frankly, I got bored. Night after night, it was the same fellas talking. I knew their stories as well as I knew my own. Well, I wouldn't say to them, because it wasn't my right or privilege to criticize the groups they want to, but I'll say to you, quite frankly, that's not AA. AA is not a series of drunken travelogues. AA is a constant reminder that we're incapable of handling our problem, but through our knowledge and relationship and turning our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him and our fellowship with each other and our willingness to share this experience with others, it's possible for us to remain sober. But much more vital is our experiences in life of sobriety than what we did when we were still drinking. There's nothing particularly new or interesting about what an alcoholic does when he gets drunk. Now, mind you, a certain amount of this kind of feat is necessary for the purpose of identification. But to make this the sole message of an AA meeting is to deny the basic message of AA and to drive people out of our fellowship, as I must say we are apparently doing. This is what's a little bit frightening when you sit at headquarters and look at the data on our movement. There seems to be a kind of a constant inflow and outgo that just about balance each other now, so that we're really not growing. And this should be a problem of concern to us, not because we want to be big, but simply that we ought to be retaining our people. And why aren't we? And I'm convinced it's because we don't, in many instances, realize the enormous opportunities for growth and stimulation and excitement and renewal that these last three steps offer. Let's look at it. Tenth step. I continue to take inventory. When I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. Now, it's a fact, although we don't like to admit it, that each of us has as his greatest source of interest himself. This is natural. This is the way we're made. We must be concerned about ourselves, because if we aren't, nobody else is going to be particularly. And this step recognizes this and points out that being human beings, we are constantly going to be getting off the beam, falling away from the course we are set. And hence, it isn't good enough to take the inventory way back there in the fourth step. It's got to be almost a daily process. When I became a 90-day wonder in the U.S. Navy during the war, one of the things they told us about was about compasses. Now, this doesn't happen so much anymore because they have gyro compasses, but the magnetic compass, as the ship sailed around the world, gets pulled away by various magnetic fields to which it passes. So when the ship finally puts into port, the compass may be quite unreliable. And so a crew of experts come aboard and they do what they call swing the compass. They put the ship through its various headings as the compass rows and put weights and magnets here and there until they've got the needle pointing right again. Now, this is what happens to all of us as we go through life. We don't exist in vacuum. We're not going around wrapped in cotton batting. We live in the midst of a rough, tough, exciting, threatening, frustrating world in which influences are pulling and tugging on us. Not just influences to drink, but influences to get us away from perhaps some of this, quote, poppycock, end quote, we picked up in essay about depending on God. After all, we're fairly sober now. We can take care of our own lives without all these other people getting along without him. Why should I? This kind of evil magnetic influence on our lives pulls our compass from pointing north. And so we need the constant inventory that we take of ourselves. And how do we take our inventory best? We take it best by coming to an AA meeting and listening to what other people have to say. I'm a very poor person to judge how I'm doing, just measuring myself against myself. I need to measure myself against these steps and the group conscience as it expresses itself on us. So each time I come to an AA meeting, I am in effect swinging my compass, getting my life directed again. Now, how can you be bored doing this? You are studying this fascinating process of what you are constantly in the process of becoming. Remember Alice in Wonderland? She got through the looking glass and she met the Red Queen, the White Queen, I guess it was, and they were in place in the landscape, and the Queen took Alice's hand and said, "Let's run," and they ran and ran and ran. They ran like mad, and they looked around. They hadn't gotten anywhere. They were still where they started out from. And Alice said, "We haven't gotten anywhere." And the Queen said, "Yes, in this country, you have to run twice as fast to get anywhere." This was Lewis Carroll's very acute observation about life. If we stand still, we actually go back. Nothing stays static in life. And we cannot coast. The effort must constantly be made to try to become the kind of people we said we were going to try and become back when we took the fourth step. Now, this is the kind of, again, it's often frustrating. It sometimes fills us with shame and guilt when we see how we are falling on our face. At the same time, it's a sure preventive of boredom, my friend. And one of the great reasons for continuing our activity within this group, where our shortcomings and offenses, praise be, are so willingly forgiven by our loving fellowship, which understands what we're trying to do. And so this is the continuing process of a life within this circle of living with ourselves, being able to look ourselves in the face squarely in the morning when we get up, either shaving or taking off the cold cream. Second step, this series, the 11th, we seek through prayer and meditation to prove our constant contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will and for the strength to carry it out. One subject on which men have spent more time studying, talking, writing, and reading than anything else is the nature of the deity. There is no one subject which has absorbed man's interest to anywhere near the extent this question has. And yet, after all these thousands of years in which men far more brilliant and capable than any of us, been struggling to find out the answers which perplex man as he confronts his creator. Even the wise realize that their knowledge is only fragmented. Here we are, the beginners of all beginners, suddenly in debt for our very lives itself to this mysterious and obscure power greater than ourselves. Should we not, even if we had no curiosity at all, out of gratitude, seek to find out more about the source of this wonderful new life for which we are so proud and for which we are so grateful? God, as we understand it. If you sat at AA meetings and were a scholar and recorded what people's expressions, you could produce a fascinating picture of what the deity is like is seen by our AA members, not from what they have read, not from what they have heard, but from what they know as his power has come into and transformed their lives. An endless, fascinating, deeply rewarding source of activity and study for as long as we live. Because if we were to devote every waking minute of our lives to exploring this 11th step, we should never do more than make the slightest, faintest scratch on the surface. So finally, there is the area of our relationships with our fellow men. We realize again that just telling people we're sorry back in the 8th and 9th steps aren't enough. We're going to be hurting people, unfortunately, as long as we live. We cannot help it. We do not live in cells. We live in a hurly-burly of life where we bump into people and step on their toes, both physically and other ways. We are constantly going to be doing things that we realize are not right. We've asked God to remove our defects of character back in these other steps, yet they return to haunt us. We should be sure by devoting ourselves to the needs of our fellow sufferers, we carry this message to alcoholics. And let me point out, however, that this isn't all of this step. This step doesn't begin, step 12, we carry the message to alcoholics. The step begins having had a spiritual experience as a result of the previous step. This language seems to me is very clear. We don't have a message to carry to alcoholics until we have worked through and struggled with and made the previous steps an integral part of our lives, and then the message comes. In another state of this great country, they have what they call two-steppers. Tell the fellows to take the first step, then put on their fireman's hat and rush out to reform the world. They haven't done anything about their own lives. They haven't tried to straighten up themselves inside. They've just decided that they were alcoholics, and as though this were the answer to help other alcoholics. Nothing much happens because this is only a small part of the message. How many AA groups really try to decide what the message is? And yet this is the thing we are supposed to be proclaiming. Alcoholism is a disease. It's part of it, to be sure. But we don't have to carry this message nearly as much as we used to. There are other people in the field talking about alcoholism being an illness. Even the American Medical Association now says so. Is our message that alcoholics get sick and drunk and into trouble and lose their jobs and get divorced and end up in prison or jail? This is a well-known fact. This is only part of the message. What do you think the message is? To me, the message is that alcoholics can recover. How do I know this? because I've been through the courts myself. Because I know tens of thousands others have. And I know how they did it. They did it by following this program. This is the message we have to give. And as long as we are concentrating on this, our work will never be done. Is a man's debt to God, as he understands him, an AA washed out by 10 years service in AA, does that pay the check? Does he go on his own now? This is the obvious inference that some people give us. I don't do anything more to AA. I came to AA for 10 years. I put my money in the hat. I did some 12-step work. Now I'm finished. It's a good thing God doesn't treat us this way, isn't it? How can we get bored or tired of AA when we consider these debts? How much will you pay for your life? Because this is what you've been given. This is what I've been given. Finally, of course, we're to practice these principles in all our affairs. A little word, a little short sentence, and yet an impossible program. What are the principles? You ever stop to think there's not a principle mentioned in the program? Here's another area of exploration, of study for AA groups. What are the principles on which our program rests? We talk about them, many of them. We've scored them all. We all know of honesty, tolerance. We mentioned humility a great deal. Of course, those few of us realize the minute they say they're humble, they're proud. But the other guys say you're humble, not you. There are other things in the program, if you look, it's patience, fortitude, perseverance, prudence, loving kindness, sympathy. And if we are to live by these rules, they're going to have to be different people. And we will become different people by trying to live by them. But this, of course, is the Council of Perfection, as the tradition points out, and the book points out, towards which we struggle, but which we never quite make. But this enables us to live in love and harmony with our neighbors. And so it seems to me these last three steps provide a constant source of growth, study, stimulation, of challenge, the yardstick against which we can measure our lives and which will, if followed, be sure antidote against boredom. I'd like to close with a story which is having increasing meaning for me as I've experienced the rewards of the AA fellowship. It's a story that's well known to you. It's an old one, about 2,000 years old. About the young man who got tired of working on the farm and asked his father for his share of what his father was going to leave him anyway when he died. The father gave it to him and the kid goes to the big town and blows it in. You know the story. And the funny thing is that when you think about the story, is that you think the young man is the person the story is all about. It isn't. The story is about his father. And what do we see about this father? He knew probably what the boy was up to, but he believed the boy was a grown man and responsible, and he let him go. He knew what was going on when the kid was up in the town. Fathers do. If they don't, the neighbors tell him. But he didn't chase after him. He didn't write him angry letters and saying, come home, stop doing what you're doing. He just sat and waited. The significant part of the story is when the young man got wise to what was going on and realized what a foolish thing he had done with his life, he started back home in the wild hope that while he would never, of course, be received back as a son again, he might have a place to live on his father's farm. The story ends up in this magnificent way that while he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and said, welcome home, my son. This is the basic thing we discover in AA when we start home. our father comes out to meet us.